Hello, anesthesia enthusiasts, and welcome to another episode of Style Points. We'll start off with another RSI, which of course stands for Resident Selected Information. Today, I'm here with Chris DiPietro, CA2 and incoming chief resident. Chris, what RSI do you have for us today?
Today, we'll be talking about neuroleptic malignant syndrome and serotonin syndrome. It's the dreaded 1 in 100,000 scenario. You induce a patient for general anesthesia using succinylcholine and propofol. Despite increasing your minute ventilation aggressively, the end-tidal CO2 increases to 60 over the next 30 minutes, and your patient becomes increasingly tachycardic. After placing the patient in the optimal position for surgery, you plug in the temperature probe to find the patient's temperature is 40.1 degrees Celsius. You call for help and initiate treatment for MH. On the surface, malignant hyperthermia may be the obvious problem here. But should the differential diagnosis stop there? Today, we're going to discuss the similarly presenting but less commonly thought of neuroleptic malignant syndrome and serotonin syndrome. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome, or NMS, is a disease of dopamine antagonism or depleted dopamine. Proposed mechanisms include disruption of the nigrostriatal pathways in the CNS, mitochondrial disruption in skeletal muscle, and dysregulation of other neurotransmitters and catecholamines, like GABA, serotonin, acetylcholine, and epinephrine. The number one cause is the use of first-generation, highly potent dopamine antagonists, aka neuroleptics, such as haloperidol, a medication that can be used in the perioperative setting for agitation and postoperative nausea and vomiting. However, commonly used antiemetics such as metoclopramide, promethazine, and droperidol also work by using dopamine antagonism and can serve as possible causes for NMS. Risk for developing NMS has been linked to higher doses of these medications, not necessarily the length of exposure. Other risk factors include surgical stress, infection, dehydration, and existing use of lithium. A commonly missed cause for NMS, which at its core is a state of a lack of dopamine, are patients who are in withdrawal from a dopamine agonist, such as a patient who receives treatment for Parkinson's disease. NMS is a clinical diagnosis. Within 24 to 72 hours of the use of the inciting factor, the onset of NMS usually follows a pattern of symptoms, the first being mental status change, such as agitation, followed by possible stupor and coma. This is often followed by so-called lead pipe rigidity, hyperthermia, and autonomic instability. Imagine you have a patient under general anesthesia with these symptoms. You do not have the ability to perform a mental status assessment, so you are left with a patient who has rigidity, hyperthermia, and autonomic instability. Sure sounds like something else, right? The first step in treatment of NMS is removing the offending agent. Discontinue all dopamine antagonists or replete with dopamine agonists as needed. There are no evidence-based treatment strategies for NMS. Treatments such as diazepam and dantrolene for skeletal muscle relaxation and bromocriptine, amantadine, and levodopa for dopamine repletion have only been successful in case reports. Further management is supportive. Ensure a patent airway. Follow ACLS guidelines as needed for arrhythmias. Obtain adequate IV access and consider invasive monitoring for hemodynamic trends and treat as needed. Externally cool the patient. Labs should be sent to address abnormalities in electrolytes and acid-base status, myocardial damage, blood counts, kidney and liver function, and muscle breakdown in the form of creatine kinase. If under general anesthesia, prompt discussion with the surgery team about aborting the procedures should be had. Discontinuation of volatile anesthetics and a switch to a total intravenous anesthesia should be considered in the off chance this is indeed malignant hyperthermia. Now, serotonin syndrome, unlike NMS, is a syndrome of excess, specifically excess serotonin causing an excitatory state in the central nervous system, leading to both central and peripheral manifestations. Causes include overdose, inadvertent drug interactions with two or more serotonin modulating agents, or even from higher doses with a single agent. Classically, the cause of serotonin syndrome was excess serotonin caused by monoamine oxidase inhibitor use when combined with an additional serotonin agent such as SSRIs. While MAOIs such as selegiline and rasagiline in the treatment of depression have fallen out of favor, some drugs with MAOI properties remain clinically relevant. While used for completely different reasons, linezolid is still a commonly used antibiotic for multi-drug-resistant organisms, and methylene blue is used for vasoplegia and methemoglobinemia. More commonly used medications like fentanyl, meperidine, tramadol, ondansetron, cyclobenzaprine, and neuropathic agents like duloxetine and amitriptyline also modulate serotonin. St. John's wort is an over-the-counter herbal supplement known for mood-boosting properties that also increases serotonin levels. Even illicit drugs such as prescribed stimulants, such as cocaine, amphetamines, and ecstasy are also common culprits. Like NMS, serotonin syndrome is diagnosed clinically. Symptoms often arise within 24 hours following a change to or the addition of a serotonin-modulating drug. Symptoms commonly include agitation, diaphoresis, tachycardia, hyperthermia, tremor, hyperreflexia, and even sometimes rigidity. The Hunter criteria is a tool to aid in diagnosis. The hallmark of serotonin syndrome is clonus, either spontaneous or induced. Again, imagine you have a patient under general anesthesia with these symptoms, but you're unable to assess for clonus because you utilized a neuromuscular blocker. Does this clinical picture sound familiar? Treatment involves prompt discontinuation of all serotonin agents. Cases with mild agitation can often be addressed with benzodiazepines. Moderate to severe cases may require aggressive sedation, ultimately endotracheal intubation, and the treatment of hemodynamic instability. Cyproheptadine, a serotonin and histamine antagonist, is typically reserved for patients for which benzos and initial supportive care efforts fail. The remainder of treatment is largely the same as already discussed with NMS. So the bad news is these diseases present similarly, especially under general anesthesia. The good news is these diseases remain extremely rare, but they almost always occur in an unpredictable fashion. That is why, as perioperative providers, it is imperative that we take a deep dive into our patients' recent medication use before they undergo anesthesia. If your patient with Parkinson's received 3 doses of high-dose haloperidol for agitation the day prior and has not received their dopamine agonist for several days, take note of this. If your patient undergoing a CABG is on 2 serotonin agents for depression and methylene blue is used on cardiopulmonary bypass for vasoplegia, again, take note of this. As always, use your best clinical judgment, but don't be afraid to ask for help from a colleague.
Chris, thank you so much. Joining us today is Dr. Andy Gurnius. Andy is the Division Director of Obstetric Anesthesia and the Fellowship Director for Obstetric Anesthesia Fellowship here at the University of Cincinnati. She completed dual fellowships in both obstetric and cardiac anesthesia and continues to practice in both domains. She also has a lot of cool tattoos and a fearless attitude. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Andy, to start, I'm going to ask you one of the standard get-to-know-you questions. If you could invite anyone in the world over for dinner, including somebody from the past or even from fiction, who would you invite and why?
I always struggle with this question. I think because deep down, I'm afraid that I'm really boring and I wouldn't be able to talk to any of these people.
That's fair.
But I think that the person that I would love to talk to most is Adam Grant. You are familiar with him, but for those who aren't, he is an organizational psychologist at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania, and he does a lot of work on change psychology, leadership psychology, and I find his ideas really interesting and very applicable to what we do in healthcare.
So what would you want to ask him about? What would you serve an organizational psychologist for dinner?
Well, God, that's a great question.
Judging you.
I'm always afraid people are judging me. I would just love to have a conversation and see where it goes and just how he comes up with the ideas he comes up with and where he finds all of his stuff. And honestly, he seems like just a pretty cool guy.
That sounds great. Well, thanks for sharing. The next thing I'd like to ask you about, could you talk a little bit more about your background? How did you come to specialize in obstetric cardiac anesthesia?
Yeah, it's not the most obvious combination, is it? But it was kind of an accident, actually. During residency, I was very much on a cardiac track. I wanted to do cardiac fellowship. I loved cardiac. It was the thing for me. You know, I liked OB, but I didn't really see it as like a fellowship type career. It was just something that I did in residency and learned about. And about 2 months before the end of my residency, we had a patient admitted who had basically a tamponade physiology. And she was also about 34 weeks pregnant with twins.
Wow.
And at the time, an unspecified number of years ago, cardiac obstetric anesthesia was just not really a thing, right? Cardiac and OB didn't really go together. The cardiologists were all freaked out that she was pregnant. Like, they wanted to be very hands-off. They didn't want to do anything. The obstetricians were very freaked out by this heart condition that they really had no idea what to do with. And I happened to be the resident on when she was admitted, mm-hmm. and saw her multiple times, did her anesthesia for her delivery. So I kind of got to follow her more than we do for most people. And what I realized from this is that we actually know about both of those things, right? We learn about a broad set of specialties in our residency. So we know about OB and we know about cardiac. And we could probably get to the point where we could combine them and figure out what to do in a way that the other people seem to be struggling with a lot more, because it had been a lot longer since they had had to really deal with any of this information. And so that's when it started to occur to me that there could be a role for us in the care of these patients and really connecting these things and managing them through delivery.
It seems like you really got to serve as the connective piece in that situation, and you decided to make a whole career out of it.
Yeah, it really was kind of a light bulb in my head. It stuck with me a lot. I ended up presenting that patient to our entire department. I still remember, I remember it really clearly. It's one of those things that just sticks with you, and you could just remember it clearly like it happened yesterday. And it really changed the course of what I decided to do with my life and career.
A lot of people think, oh no, a pregnant patient, that's a little scary. Or they also think that about the pregnant the patient with cardiac disease. Oh no, that's a little scary. But you take both of those head on. So what are some of the biggest challenges that you face in managing these pregnant patients with cardiac conditions during labor and delivery?
Well, the first thing is that all the things you said about being scared of those patients, like, I still am too. Even though I've done them a lot and I'm more comfortable than a lot of people, when we're delivering the really sick ones, I am still scared. Because there's only so much you can do. So I don't know if that helps other people to know that, but no, it's really interesting. The more I've done this, you know, some of the challenges in the beginning were more figuring out what the right thing to do was, right? What the right anesthetic was, how to keep them stable, like what the right meds were to use. And I've really gotten more comfortable with that part of it. And a couple of the things that have really come out more recently are deciding how much extra a person needs, right? You have your basic labor and delivery, your basic monitors, your basic things, right? And that's a normal childbirth experience. Because you have to remember that in the end, these women are having babies, and people tend to see that as a life experience a little bit less than a medical intervention. And some of these people with heart disease need more medical intervention. They need more care. They need ICU admission. They need different things. But that has implications for their childbirth, if they can see the baby afterwards, right? From the ICU, they can't see their baby afterwards. So that is like a huge thing for a lot of people, right? Do they need invasive monitors, which dictates kind of where they can deliver in your system? And so there are the people who are very low risk that can have kind of the quote unquote normal experience. There are the people who are very high risk, where it's kind of a no-brainer, right? To do all the things. But some of the people in the middle, it's a little tricky to decide how much they need, how much to completely change the experience, how much to take them outside of our normal routine. Because I think we also forget that there is some risk to people in altering our normal routine, right? If you take a delivering patient outside of labor and delivery, everyone gets a little freaked out about that, right? You're further away from your typical equipment, your typical meds, the people who know how to deal with that part of things. And so that's not benign either. And so that's a little bit of a tricky thing, right? We've had some recent patients that I think we've either probably overtreated, or we kind of took a risk on and pushed people's comfort level a little bit. And that's been a tricky thing to figure out.
So it sounds like we really need to decide which category of risk these patients fit into. So when we're doing that preoperative assessment of the pregnant patient with a cardiac condition, when does that start and what are you looking for?
Yeah. Well, when we evaluate people, we try to do it all as a group, right? So we have a multidisciplinary clinic with cardiologists, maternal fetal medicine doctors, and anesthesiologists. And one of the big ways that we risk stratify people is by using one of the risk assessment scores. It turns out there are actually several for pregnant women with heart disease. And the one that we tend to use most commonly is the World Health Organization. It's a numerical score from, there are five total categories. They go from one to four, and it's based on their underlying cardiac lesion and how well or poorly that lesion would be expected to tolerate pregnancy. And that really just gives you their overall risk for all of the pregnancy and peripartum period. It doesn't really nail down kind of what you need to do in the hospital. And so if we're trying to figure out kind of what we think is going to happen around delivery, right, we look at how they've done during pregnancy, how their heart's tolerated pregnancy, their serial echoes, what's happened with that, what their volume status looks like. Basically, what I want to know is how well is their heart going to tolerate the stress of either labor or a C-section and that auto transfusion that comes with delivery, because that's a big volume bolus for some hearts that may not be able to handle it. And so those are kind of the questions that I'm thinking about in my head. And I'm trying to think about how much room they have in their vasculature, right? If they're overloaded already, or if they can tolerate that. And that really dictates kind of which direction I might go with my anesthetic and how we might approach their care after delivery.
So how often are you meeting with these patients? How does that multidisciplinary clinic work?
So we have the clinic once a month. And some patients are coming every single month. If we think they're very high risk, we want to keep a very close eye on them. And in between them, they also, in between those appointments, they can also go to the high risk OB clinic, which is once a week. So the MFMs are seeing them a lot. There are some people who come to the clinic once and we say, things look pretty good. We think you're fine. And some people even come from other hospitals. They come from our community hospital, Westchester, and we say, you're so low risk, you can deliver there. You don't need to be here. These are our recommendations in general. And then you can, go forth and give birth wherever you want. And some people kind of come once every 3 months or once every trimester, or we see them once and then we get like a third trimester echo and they follow up. So it really depends on what we think their overall risk is.
Makes sense. So let's say that somebody comes in to the hospital and they haven't gotten any care beforehand. This is probably a situation that you've never seen before. What's going to be your approach towards the general history and physical of this patient? How are you going to optimize them in the brief time period that we have before they deliver?
Yeah, so I think that the most common scenario for this is somebody with peripartum cardiomyopathy. This is somebody who doesn't actually have any heart history and they develop heart failure during their pregnancy, kind of near the end. And so you could approach it kind of the same way you would approach any heart failure patient, right? You figure out their symptoms, you figure out their volume status, you assess their fetal status and figure out if there's anything urgent that needs to happen there. Because if the fetal status is not reassuring, then that changes your timeline a lot. And that's one of the big determinants of things. So you get your history, your physical, your timeline of symptoms, and usually they're going to get an echo. And so you really want to know what that looks like. And you have team meetings. You get together with everyone who's taking care of them, and you all talk through what the timeline is from a fetal perspective, from a maternal perspective, and how can you balance, the need to optimize mom and the need to deliver a baby that may or may not be doing well, depending on how mom is doing.
A lot of the medications that we would typically use on a cardiac patient might not be so good for a fetus. So, how do you navigate that space when you're talking about the risk to mom versus the risk to baby?
I mean, I think that our overall guiding principle is that a stable mom equals a stable baby. And so there are certain medications that we all kind of know to avoid, right? The ones that are bad in pregnancy, the statins, the Coumadins, Atenolol, which randomly among beta blockers is terrible for babies, apparently. And so we make sure we're avoiding those things. And all the other things are really okay for use in pregnancy with certain caveats, right? So, for example, Lasix, right? When you have a heart failure patient, you would need to diurese. That's okay in pregnancy. It has some risks to the baby, right? It can lower their fluid, it can cause, certain other things. And so they just get monitored more frequently to make sure that their fluid levels are doing okay. But we actually give it quite commonly when it's needed for our heart patients. Same thing with other beta blockers like metoprolol and labetalol and things like that. We actually use those pretty commonly because we think that optimizing mom And making her the best she can be is what's going to help baby the most anyway. And those drugs with monitoring are actually pretty safe.
The other day, I remember you staying late just so you could deliver one of your favorite lectures on what to do with a variety of lesions in the pregnant patient. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, since I know it's one of your favorite topics. How should we think about the different cardiac lesions and how they apply to a pregnant patient? And you don't have to give the entire 1 hour lecture.
Well, I can do it in less than an hour.
Okay,
I've had to do it in 15 minutes before. It's not quite as good without my diagram.
Sure.
But basically, my philosophy is that there are all these fancy risk scores that'll tell you who's going to do badly during pregnancy, who's going to struggle. But I believe that if you look at the physiology of the certain lesions, you can predict that on your own anyway without these risk scores. And the risk scores actually do bear a lot of that out. And so as a resident, I remember being in the OR and getting a table that on one side had all the valvular lesions, you know, aortic stenosis, mitral stenosis, the regurgitant lesions, hokum. And on the other, on the top of the table, was loading conditions for the heart and what the optimal loading conditions were for that lesion. So preload, afterload, heart rate, contractility. And you had to say what you thought was best for each one of those things for each cardiac lesion. Those are your anesthetic management goals, right? Those are your hemodynamic goals in the OR for that lesion to maximize cardiac output.
Okay, so get out your pencils, papers, everybody. Go ahead and draw that out before you listen to the next part of the podcast.
So I have our residents, we draw it out on the board. And, you know, we say, for example, a stenotic lesion, whether it's aortic stenosis or mitral stenosis, right? You want your heart rate to be low to increase your diastolic filling time for a stiff heart, right? You want your preload to be, I mean, relatively even, but you don't need it to be like so volume overloaded. You need enough left atrial pressure to have forward flow, but you don't need a ton of volume because you have a stiff heart and you don't want it to back up. You want your afterload to actually be maintained to high because you want to maintain coronary perfusion, for example. And your contractility, again, you want to maintain it because you're pumping against a stenotic lesion,
right?
Those are your anesthetic goals. Those are the things that are good for that lesion that are not going to get you into too much trouble. Right? For a regurgitant lesion, it's kind of the opposite. So if you've heard the fast full forward mnemonic, right, you want a higher heart rate. You want more volume because I think of regurgitant lesions as there's all this extra volume swirling in the heart. So you need a little more volume in your body to kind of make up for that. So you want your volume to be up. You want your contractility to be maintained. You want your afterload to actually be low so that more blood goes forward than backward. Then if you add another line to your table called pregnancy, and you fill in the physiologic changes that happen during pregnancy, you can actually compare what happens during pregnancy to what's best for each lesion, right? So pregnancy, right, your heart rate goes up, your preload goes up by a good amount, your afterload goes down, and your contractility is maintained. Your heart does dilate a little bit, but your contractility is maintained. So if you look at your chart and you have all those things filled out, what you'll see is that the stenotic lesions are basically the opposite in every category. Whereas the regurgitant lesions all line up pretty well. The things that are good for regurgitant lesions are the things that are happening to pregnant patients. And sure enough, they tend to do better during pregnancy.
So if you are looking through a patient's echo and you see stenotic lesions, that's going to cause more of a cortisol surge for you.
Absolutely.
Than if you saw a regurgitant lesion. That's good to know. Okay. So what kind of monitoring techniques do you use for these patients when they're on labor and delivery or when they get into the operating room? What do you think is the most helpful?
So the first thing that you have to know is what monitors your labor and delivery can support.
Makes sense.
So for example, on our labor and delivery, we can't have an arterial line in a laboring patient because the nurses on L&D, while they're very good at many things, are not really trained and experienced to manage arterial lines. They don't know how to do it. They don't know how to use the tubing. That is not our lane, and we do not want anything to do with it. And so we can't have that. If we think that a patient needs that level of monitoring, they have to labor in the ICU. And we have had patients labor in the ICU. They do not love it.
I have dealt with one or two of those on call myself.
So. Nobody really loves it, which is another challenge, right? Coordinating a delivery like that. in a patient who's in a very unfamiliar location.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you approach monitoring a patient that is so far away? What are your goals there?
Yeah, one of the things that we are lucky to have is a cardiac ICU in which we have an anesthesia critical care team who has somebody there 24/7. And so over time, the agreement we've come to is that those laboring patients who are in the ICU, right, our anesthesia critical care team is kind of the primary ICU team for that person. They're the ones who are monitoring the hemodynamics so that our labor and delivery anesthesia team, who is three floors away, doesn't have to dedicate someone to be up there all the time. So we are monitoring the labor epidural, which is checks every several hours, and the critical care team can call us if they have any questions or concerns, but we have them kind of as partners who help us with the management of that.
A lot of these pregnant patients with heart conditions are anticoagulated. How do you approach the idea of sticking a big needle in their back to do an epidural when they might need anticoagulation to prevent them from getting some horrific blood clot?
That is always a tricky scenario. Thankfully, most of the patients who are pregnant are on Lovenox. Lovenox is pretty standard for pregnant patients, and ASRA has pretty clear guidelines about stopping Lovenox before neuraxial techniques. And so, we're usually able to plan their inductions in a way that allows us to do neuraxial just like we would anyone else who's on anticoagulation during pregnancy. That's not so much different. In the rare case that they are on Coumadin, that's a lot trickier. I've had maybe two of those cases in my career, and we had a recent one where the patient was at such high risk for thrombosis that she was bridged on a heparin drip, and nobody felt comfortable turning off her heparin drip until just before the surgery. And so she actually had to undergo general anesthesia for her C-section because we were not able to stop her anticoagulation.
Wow. But it seems like that's a little bit more of a rare scenario versus most of the time you just follow the ASRA guidelines.
Exactly. Most of the time, you're dealing with a standard Lovenox dosing, standard Lovenox guidelines, and the OBs want to stop anticoagulation for delivery.
That makes sense. So after one of these babies has been delivered, the risk to mom doesn't go away. Can you talk a little bit about what common pitfalls you might see right after delivery for these patients?
Yeah. So as you probably have learned at some point, the maximum cardiac output that these patients are going to see is really right after delivery. And for a long time, I thought immediately after delivery meant like the instant the baby was delivered. That's when it was going to happen. And I've learned through time that is not really true. In C-sections, what I've noticed is probably about 10 to 15 minutes after the baby comes out is when I would start to see signs of that volume hitting their heart if I didn't do anything about it. So the patient gets more short of breath, the pulse ox starts to go down, like the blood pressure gets a little soft. You just start noticing them wobbling a little bit. And so from that point on, that's when you really start to have to worry about a big bolus of fluid hitting the heart all at once. Even if they make it through that, the day or two after delivery is when all the other fluids they've gotten that have seeped into their tissues, all the swelling they've had, that all starts to mobilize and go back into their circulation. And so you can actually get delayed reactions up to a couple days later. And so for some of the patients we're really worried about, we'll just keep them in the hospital maybe for an extra day, just to keep an extra close eye on them to make sure that they've started to kind of mobilize their fluid. You can tell their urine output picks up, they start to feel the swelling go down and know that they're doing okay with it.
Many patients come to OB with a birth plan in mind, and a lot of times anesthesia has a lot of specific roles to play or not to play in that birth plan, which, as opposed to general anesthesia, people don't usually come to us with an anesthesia plan. So, how do you navigate patient preferences when they might not be aligned with the standard of care?
So this is tricky, and it's interesting to talk about because I'm like anybody else. Some days I try really hard to have this conversation and I do a terrible job at it. And people just dig in their heels and it's awful. And some days I do a really great job. I'm like, I did everything right there. But my favorite thing to do, if I can get it right, is to go in and say, look, like you have this whole plan for how you want things to go. And I know that you've thought a lot about it and you've done research and you've read a lot of things and you've decided this is the thing that I want. But there are things about this whole experience and about you specifically that you're not going to find in your internet searches. You're not going to find in the books you can read or the books you can find, because they live in my head. And they live from my experience in taking care of patients like this and doing this over and over. And so as you think about how you want this labor to go, and as things progress and change through the day, I want to give you this information that lives in my head that you can take into account if you start thinking about how you want this day to go, and if you want to reassess, change your plan or whatever. I want you to have all that information as well.
That makes a lot of sense. It's always nice when you have some go-to lines that you can use for patients who might have an expectation that's different than the reality.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I think the best you can do is hear what they want and why they want it, and make sure that they know that they're being heard, and that we're not just saying, like, this is how it has to go and I don't care what you think, but to at least, like, live with what they want and say, these are the reasons that I want it to be the way that I want it. And that, you know, sometimes we can compromise with what you want. And sometimes it really is just a safety thing that we can't compromise on. And I will do my best to compromise where I can.
Yeah, that makes sense. So zooming out a little bit, what sort of recent advancements or research finding in obstetric cardiac anesthesia do you find most exciting or promising? What's the new frontier of what we're doing for these people?
So a lot of what you will read right now about cardio-obstetrics is the concept of the cardio-obstetric team. The cardio-OB team is the big thing people are writing about. And really, it's just the idea of multidisciplinary care and coordination, and kind of having a formal team or a structure to evaluate and care for these patients, and having a team who's experienced in these patients. So it basically functions as a referral center, just like any other, you know, uncommon condition, basically, where you go someplace where people have done this before. They have a system in place. They know what to do. Even if they don't, they know how to think through the situation together. And so you want to make sure, right, you have obstetricians, MFMs, cardiologists, an anesthesiologist, obstetric or cardiac, because most places don't have both, right? There are not a lot of people who do both of those things together. And then you want to make sure you have your people identified who are not needed for every case, but you have to maybe call into action sometimes cardiac surgeons, electrophysiologists, critical care, you know, just all the other ancillary services that might have to be involved with these people. And so that's really the big thing, is trying to get those formal systems of care to take care of these patients. What I would like to see going forward is, and this is giving me ideas, is kind of what I mentioned earlier, right? Around delivery, who do we need to escalate care for? Who's going to struggle specifically so much with delivery? Because the one drawback with these risk scores is that it doesn't tell you who's going to struggle at that particular time. It just kind of tells you your overall risk of having something happen at any point. And so if we could nail down and we could look back and say, who actually did end up struggling with their delivery? Who did end up having trouble in those first couple postpartum days? Could we actually have a little more data behind that decision of who needs more monitoring, who needs to deliver in a special place? I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah, that does sound like an interesting project. Do you want to give out your email address so that people can volunteer to be part of that?
I'm always happy to work with people who are interested in projects.
So let's say that somebody has listened to this podcast and they want to be you. They're really excited about obstetric cardiac anesthesia and they want to get cool tattoos and everything else. What advice would you give them? What would you tell them? How can they structure their career, maybe starting from medical school, aiming towards a career in obstetric cardiac anesthesia?
Well, I'm not sure you have to structure things quite as early as medical school. So deciding on anesthesia is a good first step. But when I think back to medical school, I remember liking my OB rotation even then. And so what I would say is pay attention to the things that you're enjoying and the subject matters that you're enjoying, because you don't have to do that specialty to be involved in that specialty. And I don't think I realized that back then. The nice thing about anesthesia is that you can be adjacent to a lot of fields and kind of still be involved in without primarily doing that thing. I don't have to be a cardiologist to be involved, right? Like, I do cardiac anesthesia. I'm certified in echocardiography. I don't have to be a cardiologist and see patients in clinic. That's great. So if you're interested in anesthesia, a nice thing in med school is just kind of pay attention to the other things you did enjoy and see if there's a way to incorporate that in your career in anesthesia. There's a lot of flexibility in that way. And if you are specifically interested in cardio OB, see if you have a clinic where you are. See if you can shadow somebody who actually does it. See if you can see a little bit about what the care system looks like where you are. Get an idea if it's something you might be interested in doing. Because I really like what I do. It's such a niche thing that I get a lot of phone calls, like I'm a resource for people. And that's really cool. It sometimes can cut into your off hours because not a lot of people have the knowledge that you have, but it's not too bad. And during residency, really first focus on being a good anesthesiologist. Focus on learning how to build relationships, working among a team, pay attention to obviously those two rotations that you're going to do well with, but the best thing you can do is be good at your job, your basic job. And then as far as pursuing both fellowships, the good news is, at least among the obstetric anesthesia world, there's a lot of interest in doing both of these things. And so there's a lot of support in that way to try to make it happen. People are actually really excited about it, which is funny to me because when I was doing it, everyone thought I was crazy. This is unheard of. People are like, why are you doing this? Doesn't make any sense. And now it's really a thing that people are doing. And so there's an effort to try to like dual match into fellowships. Cardiac is a little more competitive, so that can be the tricky one. I would focus on making your application good for that. Obstetric anesthesia is a wonderful specialty, but not nearly as competitive, if that's helpful. I don't
That makes a lot of sense. Is there an order in which you recommend doing the fellowships? Should you get into cardiac because it's the tougher one to get into first? What do you think?
So what I have heard people talk about is the worry from a program director standpoint is that people are going to try to get into this dual matching thing and get into the OB fellowship as like a backdoor to get into cardiac. And so a lot of places will actually want you to do the obstetric fellowship first to
Interesting.
make sure you really want to do it and not get in, do the cardiac fellowship, and then be like, actually, I don't want to do OB anymore. I don't know how much that's actually happened. I think that's just a fear that people have because cardiac is so much more competitive that they don't want to end up getting taken advantage of. So I'm not sure how much choice you would have in that, to be honest.
Okay. So lastly, let's wrap up talking about some style points. What style points or points of personal preference have brought you success in your career, both in and out of the operating room?
So for me, this will not surprise you at all. But communication is a big one. And it's something that I've become more formally interested in recently, but realized that I've really done my entire medical career. As an intern, I realized that female physicians and female nurses had a little bit of a different relationship than our male counterparts. And I realized that I was going to need to be a little bit more deliberate about building a relationship with nurses. So that when push comes to shove, right, if you're in an emergent situation, emotions are high, tempers are high, you give an order, you're not misinterpreted, right? You're a known person to these people. It goes very, very differently than if you just kind of come in, you give orders, you're dismissive, you're whatever. You don't have any like social capital, for lack of a better word. And so I started doing that then, and I've just kind of kept doing it, right? It's nothing crazy. It's nothing sinister. It's literally just stopping for a moment to chat with people, asking their opinion, giving where you can give. Like if they're like, hey, I think this is a better way and it doesn't make a difference to you, great, that sounds good. Especially as an intern, nurses have so much to tell you. They know a lot more about actually taking care of patients than you do when you first start.
Absolutely.
So, anyway. Communication, building relationships with the people you work with, and honestly, just getting everyone in the same room to talk about stuff. That's the best thing about our cardiac OB clinic is that we spend the first hour all sitting in a room together and going through all the patients and making their plans, which can change when you see them, but we're all just talking to each other in the same room. There's no messages going back and forth in the chart. There's no like phone tag. There's no, okay, well, I talked to this person, now I have to talk to the other person and then call you back. Like we're all just talking in a group.
That can make a big difference when you bring all the experts into a room. It seems like you can come to a consensus much more quickly. And by reading people's faces, you can probably see which points are more or less important and where we can make compromises.
Yeah. And I bring residents to the clinic, not because I think everyone is going to be interested in cardio OB anesthesia, but because I actually want them to see what that looks like, what that whole conversation with everyone in a room, how constructive it is, how easy it is to come up with a plan that way. And almost universally, despite any skepticism going into it, they find it to be a very positive experience. They think it's cool. They learn a lot. It helps that I don't make them write a lot of notes.
Sure.
but no, I think that they enjoy the experience and seeing what it's like. And, you know, even beyond a formal clinic, when I'm on the OB floor and we have a question about something, I'll just go to the OB residence, to the bubble where they do all their work. And I'll just sit down and I'll be like, hey, guys, what's up? And we just talk. And then I'll just stay and chat with them for a few minutes. And I think that's really helped how I interact and work with them and, in general, other people on that floor.
Well, those are very helpful. And I think that that can be appreciated no matter what flavor of anesthesia you do.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much a universal concept in life that will help you anywhere.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this episode of Style Points. Now, I've deliberately increased the difficulty level of liking, subscribing, or leaving a review of the podcast, so I don't actually think you'll be able to do any of those things. Or am I just using reverse psychology? Or maybe double reverse psychology? Is anything real? Do any of us exist beyond this current moment? Okay, we're all done. Open your eyes.